evening, Mark, and thank you. Thank you, and good evening to you. Good afternoon or good morning. Thank you for joining us here, Broken Bread, our weekly Bible study, joint production of me, Ron Bailey, at BibleBase.com, Mike Coles, NewLifeRadio.co.uk, in Exeter. It's our privilege and joy to spread this feast week by week as God enables us. So we're really glad you've joined. We're on study 33 tonight. This is a series of studies called To the Churches of Galatia. And we've done a study now within a study, which was intended to be six studies looking at what is man. So this, in a sense, that I'm doing tonight should be study 33, and we should be moving on into Galatians proper. But as they say, the best laid plans of mice and men. So I've called this one study 33, 7 of 6. And I've called it Battle Ready. I decided there were things I wanted to say before we moved back into Galatians. I wanted to set the tone, the seed, the scene, the atmosphere as far as I could. So what I'm calling this is Battle Ready. And I want to talk about, first of all, about my first section I'm calling Great Expectations. I love the first chapters of the book of Joshua. It's thrilling, of course. It comes after the tragedy of Numbers, when they were all up and ready to go, all in their ranks, all ready to move forward and to take the promised land. And then because of their sin, their rebellion, their disobedience, God calls it an example of disobedience, an example of unbelief. They said no to the promise of God. And as a result of that, they spent 40 years in the wilderness. And then at the end of that, you come to Numbers, then into Deuteronomy, and Moses repeats the law to them and explains that it's going to become the tenancy agreement for the land that God is giving to them. And then in the few chapters that follow, you've got the death of Miriam, and then the death of Aaron, and then the death of Moses, and the new scene kind of comes into view. And we come to the book of Joshua, which in the Greek Old Testament, in the Septuagint, is actually called Jesus. Yeah, Jesus or Jesus, because Joshua, of course, is the Hebrew form and Jesus is the Greek form. So we actually have in our Bibles a book called the Book of Jesus. And if you read it with that in mind, you will see things perhaps that you haven't noticed on the earlier reading. So what is it I like about Great Expectations? Well, just listen, they are poised now. They've got to cross the River Jordan. They've got to get into the Promised Land. But this is what God says. I'm reading here from Joshua chapter 1. I'm going to read the first three verses. And as with all these things, I usually take my Old Testament readings from the American Standard Version of 1900 because it retains the these and thous and for other reasons. I want you to listen to this passage, if you will, or follow it with me, and see, notice the words that I emphasize. Now, it came to pass, after the death of Moses, the servant of Jehovah, that Jehovah spoke unto Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, thou, and all this people, unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, to you have I given it, as I spoke unto Moses. If you listen to that, that's quite a complex promise, because you've got these and yous in it. And when God says thou, he's actually referring to the man Joshua, whose Greek name is Jesus. He's referring to Jesus and giving him the commission to go over through the river of death into the promised land and to bring the land under subjection with his people. But also in that passage, you've got references to you, because this is a promise given to Joshua, not just for Joshua's benefit, for the sake of the people of Israel. And then in verse 5, it goes on to say, there shall not any man be able to stand before thee, Joshua, all the days of thy life, Joshua. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Be strong and of good courage, for thou shalt cause this people to inherit the land which I swear unto their fathers to give them. So Joshua is going to cause the people to inherit the land. So the conquest of the land really would be in the hands of Joshua. And as long as the people remained rightly related to him, as long as they did what he told them, as long as they followed his word, every step that they took, every place that the sole of their foot landed, that would become their land. I wonder if you've ever, maybe it's just me who does this kind of thing, but do you know how many casualties Israel suffered in the conquest of the land? Do you know? Do you know how many casualties the Canaanites suffered? Well, let me tell you, just as by way of contrast, the Canaanites had 32,000 casualties, mortalities, fatalities, from the first three battles. 32,000, the first three battles. For the whole of the period of the conquest, Israel sustained 36 mortalities. 36 against tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. And those 36, yes, you can probably remember, they all occurred in one place. At the Battle of Ai. So they went up thither of the people of Israel, about 3,000 men, and they fled before the men of Ai. And the men of Ai smote of them about 36 men. There you are, there's the casualty. And they chased them before the gate, even unto Shebarim, and smote them at the descent, and the hearts of the people melted, became as water. You see, the expectation was that they would conquer with every step they took, under the leadership of Joshua. So they had great expectation, hence our title for the first thing. And we're going to come into Galatians and we're going to observe a battle that's taking place. But I want us to go with this mindset. I want us to understand that we're going to this battle with our Jesus Joshua as our leader. And if we obey him and follow his instructions, if we exalt him and listen to what he is saying, every step we take will be victory. Everyone. And you say, oh, that's just wishful thinking, isn't it? Well, do you believe that God is able to keep us from falling? Do you believe that God is able to do more exceeding abundantly above all that you ask or think? Do you believe that God is able to save to the uttermost? Okay, so what's your problem? Why should we not know a life of complete victory? Our expectation of every step should be victory. There's an old story, I don't know how many of these stories about Spurgeon are true. There's an old story told about someone who said to Charles Spurgeon, Mr. Charles Spurgeon, he would never allow people to call him Reverend. They said to him, Mr. Spurgeon, when I preach the gospel, I don't see people coming to God in the way that you do. And apparently, he had quite a sense of humor, Spurgeon. Apparently, Spurgeon said to them, well, do you expect to see converts every time you preach? And the young man said, oh, no, sir. Spurgeon said, that's your problem. Dennis Clark, an old preacher, used to sometimes say cynically to people, according to your unbelief, be it unto you. Now, I'm not just saying that we pick verses out of the air and make them our own. That isn't. But there is an expectation of victory. God's provision and guidance we need to have in our hearts as we come to observe that battle. So how can we be in best trim? How can we be battle ready for this? I was zooming to Rora Church in Devon on Sunday for their morning meeting. I was speaking from Hebrews, and I find parts of this kind of coming very freshly to my mind. In the second chapter of Hebrews, we're warned of the danger of drift, that if we don't keep certain things in view, if we don't keep our eye on what we're supposed to be doing, then we will drift. And it's an image of a boat being tied up, and maybe just the gentle lapping of the river, the currents, or the waves slowly loosen it, and slowly, so peacefully, it just drifts away. Drift, drift. And apparently the great danger is drift. William Booth once addressed a company of his young officers who were about to be commissioned and go out different places, men and women, and he addressed them on the topic. This was how he began it, apparently. He said, "It is in the nature of a fire to go out." It's a sobering thing, isn't it? It is in the nature of a fire to go out. So stir it up, said the scriptures, in several different places. If you look, you'll find that you're encouraged to stir things up. You're to consider him. You're to keep your eyes on Jesus Christ. And that brings us to Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14. It says this: "Seeing then that we have a great high priest..." Oh, let me go back a bit. Let me go back to Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 1. This is what it says. After it warned us about the danger of drift, about not neglecting this great salvation that God has made available for us, in chapter 3 and verse 1, it says this, it says, "Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling..." I want to stop at every word here, Dan. "Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider..." And it means deeply consider. It means get right to the bottom of it. It means give it, go deep, 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 deep down to the very bottom in your thinking, considering. Consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus, who was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was faithful in all his house. So it says, consider the apostle. We don't often think about Jesus, the apostle. But he was. Constantly in John's gospel, he refers to himself as the one whom God has sent, the one whom the Father has sent. It's the verb apostello. This is the noun apostolos. Jesus was the great apostle. And an apostle is someone who has been sent on a commission with a message, with something to say. He's been entrusted by somebody. Jesus came as the witness. He came as the witness to the character of God. And if we would not drift, if we would stay securely anchored, prospering in the things of God, we must consider him. We must give thought Jesus Christ himself, to his ministry, to the way that he has revealed God to us. "I've revealed to them your name," says Jesus in John 7, "and I will reveal it to them," so that as an ongoing revelation of the character of God in the person of Jesus Christ, function as the commissioned apostle to bring the revelation of the will of God and the nature of God to men and women. And then, and I'm hurrying on, he says, "and the high priest." Well, the high priest, of course, is the one, his ministry is past, present, and future. He offered the sacrifice which brought us near to God. He offered up himself, the just for the unjust, to bring us to God, just like the priests were unable to give access to God. And of course, he continues, "We have such a high priest." Not, this isn't something he did in the past. We have such a high priest now, who is continuing to function for us, continuing to minister grace and life to us. "Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our..." So, a little bit later on in chapter 4, it says, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we..." I'm going to emphasize some words again. "We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses." Take the word weaknesses with you onto the battlefield. Remind yourselves that we have weaknesses. Not sins, we have weaknesses. There are frailties in the human condition that are part of our humanness, and they will be with us on the battle. They will be with us in the hour of temptation. They were with him. He was crucified through weakness, says Paul to the Corinthians. We don't have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness, but was in all points tempted as we are. He was tempted, you will be. There's no escape from temptation. Only dead are tempted. I mean, really dead. And then it says, he was tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need, or as it sometimes says, so one version actually says, in the nick of time. So there are going to be times and seasons when we need grace in special measure. There are going to be times of trial and temptation. There are going to be times when our weaknesses are exposed and our enemy will make the most of them. And all that doesn't sound very encouraging, except that this verse begins by saying, seeing then we have a great high priest. What about those times and seasons? Here it speaks in Hebrews 2 of the sword of the Spirit, the word of God, able to make divisions, not to divide them into parts, but to divide them into heads or categories so you can see. And it speaks about the thoughts and the intents of the heart. And there will be times when the thought and the intents will be difficult to distinguish. I'm just looking for a quotation I've got for you. This is a letter. This first bit I'm going to tell you now is actually from the diary of somebody named Hannah Ball. She was a fascinating lady. She lived in High Wycombe and was one of the stalwarts, one of the pillars of the Methodist meeting there. And she said this. She says, she writes in her diary, I'll find it. She writes in her diary, and she said that she's been troubled by many unpleasant thoughts today. And she says, but I didn't invite them, and I didn't welcome them, so I don't class them as sin. I regard them as temptation and trial. That's a good policy. Not everything that enters your mind is actually entered from your own thought. Don't believe everything you hear. Don't believe all your thoughts. We have an enemy who is able to plant thoughts in minds. But if they're not your thoughts, if you didn't invite them, and you didn't welcome them, they're not sin, they're temptation. As the old hymn says, yield not to temptation, for yielding is sin. It's not the temptation, it's the yielding that is. So, let's go on a little bit. We have this great high priest, and I just want, in the couple of minutes we've got left now, to go through this verse, go through it like this. It says here that we have a great high priest, and because we will be tempted, because we will have witnesses, because there will be times of extra trial, there will be seasons that these things will come, they will, inevitably. Let us therefore, because he is the high priest with the provision, let us come therefore boldly to the throne of grace. Now, sometimes we use this language and we use it to mean prayer. Well, it can include prayer, but the throne of grace isn't a synonym prayer. It's actually an expression speaking of the fact that this high priest of ours sits upon a throne, unlike Israel's. Priest, they weren't allowed to have seats, never mind thrones. But our high priest sits on a throne. The throne he sits upon is the throne of grace. In order that we may, this is the word, take hold of mercy. Mercy. I often use this. I've forgotten where I got it from now. I think I've added a bit to it. But justice is when we get what we deserve. Mercy is when we don't get what we deserve. But grace is when we get what we could never. I have a Scottish brother. I see him from time to time, and whenever I ask him how he is, he always says, "Enjoying the grace of God in spite of you." Grace is in spite of you. Yep. Grace is not dependent upon you at all. So we may obtain mercy. I'll say it again. Justice is when we get what we deserve. Mercy is when we don't get. Grace is when we get what we could never deserve. Notice what it says here, that we may lay hold of mercy and, oh, fresh, something additional. We may lay hold of mercy and discover grace. This is a wonderful thing. We come to God for mercy and discover. We come to God looking to Him to spare us, to not give us what our deeds have deserved. But we discover grace, which is when we get what we could never do. On the battlefield, at the time of the greatest need, in other words, in time of need, at that point, we shall find grace. I'll tell you one last thing about this amazing verse. This word help, in the modern versions, it's succor, the older versions. We may obtain mercy and find grace to help or to succor. It's a Greek word which is made up of two words. It's one word which means to cry, and the other word means run. So originally, this word meant to run to the sound of cry. In other words, to rescue. You may come boldly to the throne of grace. You may obtain mercy and discover grace. Runs to the rescue in the nick of time. That's why we can step onto the battlefield. Not that we choose our own battlefield, but that's why we can be battle ready, because we have a great hybrid, and there is no possible circumstance on earth where this verse, to those who are His, to those who will come to Him, to those who know what it is to know an uttermost salvation, to those who keep coming to Him. That's the mood of the verse, of the verb. There's nothing on earth can stop you being victorious. There's nothing on earth can stop you putting your foot on the neck of your enemy. There's nothing on earth can stop you if you will come, remembering the apostle, High Priest of our King, coming with boldness to the throne of grace. You may take hold of mercy and discover grace that runs to the sound of your voice in the nick of time. Remember this, grace always comes. He never gives grace until the dying hour. You can't save it. You can't plan for it. You can't do any of those things. All you can do is in the moment, in the nick of time, you can lift your heart to your High Priest. Run. I have to go now. I'm on my way to it. So thank you again for being with us today. The Lord bless you. Put on all your armor. Be battle ready, God willing, this time, this place, this day, next week.